From New England Public Radio in Springfield, Massachusetts, this is NEPR News Now. Stories you really should not miss. Thanks for the download or the stream. Thanks for listening. I'm Sam Hudzik, the news director at New England Public Radio. On the show today, is it time for a new definition of farmer?
You picture the one cow, Farmer Joe like me, I got the thing, and I'm going to tell you a story about my tomatoes and my peppers.
What about the sun? Some farmers are looking to harvest solar energy. Then we hang out with a group of protesters holding firm against a pipeline expansion through Otis State Forest in Sandusfield, Massachusetts. Even though it's looking mighty unlikely they're going to win.
But we have to know that this is happening in our backyard, and we have to take a stand because it's not okay.
A visit to the protesters' clubhouse of sorts. And our summer fiction series continues. Federal judge slash novelist Michael Ponzer says his professions sometimes collide.
Sometimes I think lawyers hope, mostly out-of-town lawyers, hope that they might, in a sense, curry favor with me by saying that they'd read my book and enjoyed it.
Ponzer's new book is called The One-Eyed Judge. All that just ahead on NEPR News Now. But first, local law enforcement cannot detain someone based solely on a request from federal immigration officials. That's the ruling from the highest court in Massachusetts. The decision on so-called ICE detainers comes at a time when the involvement of local police in enforcing federal immigration policies is under heavy scrutiny. WBUR's Shannon Dooling reports.
Shrey Nguyen Lun was facing larceny charges in February. The charges were ultimately dismissed in municipal court, and at that point, Lun was free to go. But the court continued to hold him on a request from U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. In its ruling, the Supreme Judicial Court found Massachusetts law does not authorize such a detention based solely on that request from immigration officials. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions has called ICE detainers an important tool for public safety. But Emma Winger, an attorney for Lun, disagrees.
Detainers only apply to folks who have, for example, been found not guilty, or their case has been dismissed, or a judge has determined that they should be released on bail. So this case doesn't in any way threaten the public safety of Massachusetts residents.
Still, some local law enforcement officials are concerned. In a statement, Bristol County Sheriff Thomas Hodgson said, quote, "The decision makes Massachusetts residents and visitors more vulnerable to become victims of crime." An important distinction in the SJC's ruling notes that these voluntary requests from ICE are not criminal warrants, and under state law are not enough to hold someone who would otherwise be free to go. Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey's office represented the Commonwealth in the case. Healey says she welcomes this clarification from the court.
It basically says that everyone has to follow Massachusetts law, including the federal government. It makes sense as a matter of both immigration policy and practices, but it also makes sense in terms of public safety, and that's what we've been saying all along.
Healey says this is the first decision of its kind in the country. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Shannon Dooling.
And since that story aired, Governor Charlie Baker and some Republicans in the legislature announced plans to come up with a couple different versions of legislation to let the Massachusetts State Police honor those ICE detainers in some circumstances. When lawmakers rolled out their bill in a press conference on Beacon Hill, they got shouted down by protesters.
In our community.
Are you imagining? Do you have facts? Do you have facts? Give us the facts. Based on a statement of facts, not imagining. Keep hate
out of our state.
Keep hate
out of our state.
Keep hate
out of our state.
Would you please stop interrupting?
If you stop,
no, we have, no, you don't run. You're not the boss here.
Oh, you're not the boss too.
I've asked you to be polite. I've asked you to be polite. We've set up ground rules. Everyone else is following them, but you.
Yeah, but
I would ask you
what
you can speak all you want
please.
When you're recognized.
Please.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're being very disrespectful.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
You're also being very disrespectful with our communities. For decades, for years. That's why we're here.
Are you going to let us speak?
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Thank you.
Go ahead. No problem.
That was State Rep Jim Lyons of Andover there bickering with activist Patricia Montez. And they're supporting the bill, Bristol County Sheriff Thomas Hodgson. He's the guy who wanted to send prisoners from his jail down to the southern border to help build that wall President Trump has his heart set on. Preserving farmland can be a struggle, which means some farmers looking to make ends meet are now turning to another harvest, the sun. But as Patrick Scahill from WNPR reports, solar energy is providing many farmers with new opportunities and questions.
As Kevin Sullivan slowly rumbles his pickup truck across his 60 acres of property near the Connecticut-Massachusetts border, he leans in and asks me a question. What's farmland?
You picture the one cow. Farmer Joe like me, I got the thing, and I'm going to tell you a story about my tomatoes and my peppers.
But what non-farmers generally don't picture, he says, is how to pay for it.
So there's this whole, you know, what's farmland? What's usable farmland? Well, usable farmland is something that can sustain a household.
And for a while, Sullivan says one part of his property was pretty unusable, about 15 acres where the soil was heavy and bad for growing. He tried raising corn and hay, but then a solar developer came along, offering him a lot of money to rent the land, put up solar panels, and sell that energy back into the grid. He says the opportunity was too good to pass up.
The money that comes off that acreage exceeds anything else I could do out there.
For solar developers, southern New England is ideal. Tax credits and locked-in contracts with power utilities can help the finances work out, and many New England farms are basically move-in ready.
It's a large tract of land that's flat and already cleared, and it's right next to a big transmission system. So it is a perfect place for a solar project.
That's Deepwater Wind CEO Jeff Grabowski speaking at a meeting to explain his company's plans to buy up some land outside of Hartford. It wants to put panels on about 156 acres of property, some of which is rented to grow crops. If built, it could be New England's biggest solar project, powering about 5,000 homes. Some residents think the project is a waste of agricultural space in a densely populated state, but for nearby farmers like Benjamin Freund, who both own and rent farmland, it's complicated.
It's one of those issues, you know, call me in 10 minutes and I'll be on the other side of it.
Freund says he used to just compete against other farmers when looking for land to rent. Now he's up against deep-pocketed solar developers, too. But for farmers who own property, he thinks land use should remain a personal choice.
We want to have the ability to use our land for whatever we feel is its best and highest use. And on the other hand, we don't want to have to compete against an industry that's fairly highly subsidized.
Through incentives. And while some states are working to steer solar to places like old landfills and get more environmental oversight in the siting process, the state of Massachusetts is proposing taking the incentive idea a step further, offering more money for projects where farming and solar coexist. It's called dual use. Johnny Rogers is a livestock farmer who also works with North Carolina State University educating farmers about pasturing animals. He says he started thinking about dual use 3 summers ago when he got a call from his landlord telling him he'd agree to put solar on a portion of the pasture that Rogers was renting.
We actually live on that same farm, so, you know, it did literally hit pretty close to home.
So Rogers reached out to the solar company, asking if they'd let him keep sheep on the property, munching on the grass to make sure the panels stayed clear of brush. He says he now gets calls from other farmers and solar developers asking about the idea.
You're harvesting solar energy as electricity, then you're harvesting solar energy as protein, basically, you know, through the lamb that would be produced.
Rogers says farmers are resilient, and while he hates to see crops disappearing, he says solar has provided a lifeline to some farm owners in rural parts of his state. Money that he says can stabilize balance sheets and ensure land stays, in one form or another, farmed. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Patrick Scahill in Hartford.
That story is part of the energy reporting project, The Big Switch, from the New England News Collaborative. Construction continues on a New York to Connecticut natural gas pipeline running through Otis State Forest in Sandusfield, Massachusetts. Despite work being well underway, there are some who believe the project, which has been the source of a legal and regulatory battle, can still be halted. And a few still protest every day on private land only yards from the construction site. New England Public Radio's Adam Frenier a few weeks ago paid a visit.
A small triangle of this property comes right up to the boundary with Otis State Forest and gives a close look at what's going on. Next to existing buried pipelines, crews have cleared a long swath of trees and new large green pipe sits atop the soil waiting to be buried. There's not much work going on near us during my visit, but much of the construction in this area has been under the watchful eye of one of the property's owners, Sue Baxter.
There's absolutely no way that it's reasonable for them to put a pipe or allow a pipe to be put on this property until they allow our due process of our complaint.
Baxter is talking about the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which had granted pipeline opponents a rehearing. That hasn't happened yet since FERC doesn't have a quorum of members. Still, regulators gave the company Kinder Morgan the okay to begin anyway. Baxter and others who have joined her have a front row seat, maybe a few dozen feet from the pipeline. They sit in a portable shelter dubbed the Henry David Thoreau Cabin. It's made up of a wooden deck without walls and a post and beam frame holding up a corrugated metal roof.
Oh, it's very symbolic, but it's also tremendously practical,
providing some shelter from rain and the sun. Today, Stephen Botkin of Pelham, Massachusetts, joins Baxter, two others, and a dog. Botkin says being here in this sort of demonstration helps to bring attention to the construction project.
The pipeline folks don't want this to be visible, and we can go along our daily lives and not see it because it's kind of tucked away back here in the corner. But we have to know that this is happening in our backyard, and we have to take a stand because it's not okay.
There's a few remaining legal and regulatory challenges, but barring something unforeseen, it would take a lot at this point to scuttle the project. Still, Baxter says for the sake of the environment, it's worth trying to stop at any stage.
Even just this 3.81-mile pipeline loop not being completed makes a difference.
And as long as work does continue, Baxter will be there, either in the cabin or watching through binoculars high atop her custom-made wooden lifeguard chair. For New England Public Radio, I'm Adam Frenier.
And an update to that story. Just this past weekend, 22 protesters were arrested for trespassing on that pipeline construction site. That follows the arrest a few months back of 18 protesters. Some of the protesters who were arrested back then were also arrested this past weekend. So the fight continues. And now for the latest installment of our summer fiction series. When Springfield federal judge Michael Ponser semi-retired after three decades on the bench, he started to enjoy two privileges of part-time work. He could choose the type of cases he wanted, and he had a lot more time for his other professional passion, fiction writing. A few years ago, his first legal thriller, The Hanging Judge, reached the New York Times bestseller list. His second, The One-Eyed Judge, features the same main character, Judge David Norcross, who Ponser insists is only loosely based on himself.
Judge Norcross is far less experienced than I am. In some ways, he's a nicer, sort of more ingenuous person.
Ponser tells New England Public Radio's Karen Brown he wanted to do more than just tell a gripping story.
If I don't tell a good story, nobody's ever going to open the book. It is also true, though, that part of the engine of the book is my desire to kind of take the reader by the hand and bring the reader right up on the bench with me and sit them there right next to me and have them see and hear and feel what it means to be a judge.
Now, I couldn't help but wonder whether it might be awkward at some point for a sitting judge to, you know, you're in the courtroom with lawyers and defendants who now are able to read your innermost thoughts, at least the material that you've chosen to write about. And you do have some explicit sex scenes and some frank assessments of lawyers and defendants and other characters, albeit fictional.
It hasn't been terribly awkward, but there have been moments when I've had lawyers come up to me and say, gee, when I was in court before you and presenting a case to the jury, I couldn't help thinking about that one section in your book with Judge Norcross. Now, of course, I can say that Judge Norcross is not the same as me, but it's natural for lawyers to think of that. Sometimes I think lawyers hope, mostly out-of-town lawyers, hope that they might, in a sense, curry favor with me by saying that they'd read my book and enjoyed it. And we always move on quickly from that.
Now, in your beginning author's note, you know, at the beginning of the book, you apologize for the darkness of the subject matter in this novel, which is child pornography, child sexual abuse. Given that, you know, why did you choose to write about this subject?
What I wanted to write about were the very hardest cases a judge has to deal with. So my first book was about a death penalty case, and I had a death penalty case. The second most difficult for me has always been the child pornography cases because the material is so appalling. You know, I could do a simple, easy case, but I wanted to talk about a case that's really difficult and has very profound moral and emotional elements.
Now, part of the story also involves, your main character, Judge Norcross, debating whether to recuse himself from this child pornography case because his girlfriend is friends with the defendant. Does being a thriller writer yourself pose any conflicts of interest? You know, if you had a future case that was similar to this, would that affect whether you would want to preside over it as a real judge or not?
Well, it's been 4 years now that I've been a published novelist. It hasn't come up. I no longer, as a senior judge, 3 years ago, I stopped taking criminal cases completely. So part of the adjustment that I've made as what you might call a partially retired judge is that I only handle civil cases now. So the possibility of conflict is minimal.
Did you make that decision because you started writing criminal thrillers?
No. It's very hard to describe how sentencing people, and I'm talking sentencing people to literally thousands and thousands of years in aggregate, wears you down. And I was ready to stop doing that. But it didn't have anything to do with my writing.
So was there a part of writing this book that came from a certain idealism on your part?
Well, I'd say a strong independent judiciary is the difference between a free people and a tyranny. We have to recognize that it will sometimes fail. And if I can draw a picture of what it's like to be a human being within that system, earnestly trying to do the right thing, then I will have succeeded, and I hope I will have created something that'd be worth reading.
Michael Ponzer's new book is The One-Eyed Judge. He spoke with New England Public Radio's Karen Brown. You can find more selections from our summer fiction series at NEPR.net. This podcast is produced by New England Public Radio, a listener-supported public media company that brings you news and music, and NEPR.net. Check it out, and while you're there, you can make a contribution to New England Public Radio. Click the orange donate button at the top of the screen. All right, thanks for listening to NEPR News Now, stories you really should not miss. You can subscribe to any of NEPR's podcasts wherever you get your podcasts or at NEPR.net/podcast. Until next time.